Blog Talk Radio.
This is Chief for Yourself. Now, here's Gio.
Hi, welcome to Chief for Yourself. Great to have you with us today, wherever you are in the world at this moment. Our guest on this program was on the show a few years ago. Thomas M. Sterner is an author and speaker who's done speaking engagements around the world. He also happens to be accomplished as a musician, composer, licensed pilot, and recording and audio engineer too, along with athletic pursuits such as archery and golf. And I think he has a very inspiring personal story too about the power of intention. We'll get to that in just a few moments. Thomas Sterner is the author of Fully Engaged, Using the Practicing Mind in Daily Life. And Tom, last time you were with us, you talked about your book, The Practicing Mind, Developing Focus and Discipline in Your Life. Now we have Fully Engaged, Using the Practicing Mind in Daily Life. And I've heard you say your books really don't just start and finish. Your writing process is more of a continuum. So I'll ask you, what prompted you to write Fully Engaged?
Well, thank you for having me on the show. And what prompted me to write Fully Engaged was that when I originally wrote The Practicing Mind, I felt like I had pretty much covered everything I had to say on the subject. And what I really miscalculated was the response to the book, the reach of the book. I mean, the book is now in, I've lost count, I think 8 languages. It's being read all over the world, and people are contacting me all the time. And I guess the only complaint I ever got was they wish the book was longer. I felt like through conversations with people in coaching sessions and working with people in groups like corporate stuff and speaking engagements, through the Q&A sessions, people were basically asking the same type of question after reading The Practicing Mind. So I began to feel like I could add information to it, and it is Fully Engaged really is a continuation of The Practicing Mind. I wrote it to be a standalone book, but at the same time, it could be considered another 7 chapters on the end of The Practicing Mind. The books flow together very well, and it's the same type of a format where I just basically share information through storytelling about my own life and people that I've worked with. So I was inspired to write it, and out of gratitude for all of the wonderful input that I got from people that have read The Practicing Mind.
And before we get into the heart of the book, let's talk exactly about what Fully Engaged means. Can you give us a definition?
Well, Fully Engaged to me means understanding the experience of being fully absorbed in the process of what you're doing right here and now. And that's something that is very foreign to us. We are finding through the studies, that people are, our brains are being asked to operate at a faster and faster pace in order to deal with the culture and the technology. And that's a good thing, but at the same time, we're losing our ability to focus on any particular thing for any length of time. Attention spans are getting shorter and shorter, and our brain is basically atrophying in its ability to concentrate. And so, to me, fully engaged means to relearn how to be completely absorbed in the present moment and what you're doing right now. When you're operating in that mode, you have access to your full consciousness, which usually we don't. Usually our mind is running around. It's visiting all these circumstances. Almost, I would liken it to background tasking on a computer. There's all these things running in RAM that really have nothing to do with the actual application that we're trying to get done right now. And it's stealing processor power from us. It makes us tired. And we're not even aware that it's happening. So that, to me, is what fully engages. It's relearning how to be completely present in what you're doing.
And it sounds like it came into play in the writing of your first book, because you said had you been more clear, you would have made more progress in your writing. What happened there?
Well, in my writing, when I first started to when I wrote The Practicing Mind, as I said, at that time, I put down what I had thought had covered the subject. And I talked about different areas of being, you know, understanding process versus product, understanding the value of being more attached to the process of achieving a goal and not so much the product of that you were trying to achieve, because we spend, you know, 99% of our time in the process of achieving our goals. The moment we actually realize the goal is very short compared to the process that is involved in accomplishing anything. So if we can learn to turn that around and be much more absorbed in that and have that be where we want to spend our time, that be our goal, then we end up experiencing this contentment and joy. Our mind slows down because it's not being asked to process all these different things in the background. Our thoughts thin out. We have more energy. There's all these things that occur from that. And I felt like that was the kind of stuff that in coaching people and trying to figure out, well, how do I convey this information more clearly to these people? That was stuff that started to come out as, in the years after I wrote The Practicing Mind, and which made me understand, well, I could talk about this through some stories, and I could make this information a little dig deeper, I guess, is probably the best word for it, and I could give people more information that would be helpful.
Now, you had duties, obviously, aside from your writing. You had the duties of house and home, raising a family, and all of that over the years. Did you ever get discouraged in your writing process, or at least sidetracked by all of the things you had to tend to other than writing?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, I did. You know, I'm a very creative person. I always have been. And, you know, when I would feel inspired thoughts, I couldn't always actualize them, meaning, you know, I remember, and I mentioned this in The Practicing Mind, you know, there were times when my daughters were young. They're adults now, but when they were young, and I was at a lot of times I was a stay-at-home parent because I was self-employed, and we worked things out so that I could stay home and work out of the house for a certain amount of time. And, you know, they would be young, and they would need my attention. And I was writing, I actually wrote The Practicing Mind in the mid-90s, and I would have these ideas. Oh, I got to cover this topic. I got to think about this. I got to make sure I don't forget to put this in there. And I couldn't do that because I had these children to take care of. And it was one of the things that made me realize that I was not being present in the process of what I was doing right then, which was watching my kids and interacting with them. And I was actually missing out on moments that I would never be able to recapture. And so that was, I mean, everything I have ever written about has been through a learning process of me reading and researching and then applying it to my life and then seeing where I felt like I was weak and where I was strong and how I changed this and how I learned that. And that's really how I've shared all the information that I have written about. And it's all been through trial and error.
Mentioned that you worked in the music industry, and you are a musician yourself, and you worked with some really big names, people like Ray Charles, Tony Bennett, Luciano Pavarotti, and that's in keeping, I think, with what we're talking about today. And I'm wondering if you ever saw a meditative quality in these larger-than-life figures, or was it mostly just raw talent?
No, nobody gets to where they are. You know, if you talk to those people, and I spent a lot of time on a daily basis with some of the biggest names in the world. I was in their dressing rooms. I was at rock concerts in the trailers, you know, sitting next to the performers working on keyboards. They generally don't like the word talent because to them, they feel like it invalidates the hard work that they've put into getting to where they are. And many of them have a very meditative quality to them in terms of, you know, their practice routine. And you would see that. They would be on stage and they would be just alone with their instrument, or they would be downstairs waiting to go on the stage for the performance, and they would be sitting in their dressing room with their instrument, and they would have a very meditative quality. So I think that that's really underestimated by the public because they don't see that. And in fact, I remember seeing a very well-known jazz pianist who was playing at the Newport Jazz Festival, and he was interviewed after his performance, and the interviewer said that. He said, you know, how does it feel to be so talented? And the guy said, what is this? He goes, no, this is talent has nothing to do with what I'm doing. He said, this is hard work. It took me a lot of hard work to get here. It has nothing to do with this talent thing. He said, I don't really understand what that is. And I think that most people that are artists like that, that's the way that they feel about it.
Hmm. Why is it that our minds resist being in the present moment so much?
I think the mind resisted because, for one, we have a lot of distractions. You know, we are connected to the marketing media 100% of the time through smartphones, through tablets, through computers, through television. It doesn't matter where you go, you're being marketed to. Whether, you know, if you're in the car, I mean, now we want tablets in the car, keep the kids distracted. If you go into a sandwich shop, they've got televisions up on the wall, they've got music playing. There's this constant bombardment of media in us, and so the mind is always trying to process all this stuff that has nothing to do with where we are and what we're doing. And the goal of this marketing and this media is to make you feel, it's to capitalize on a feeling that we all have of being incomplete. And it always makes the mind feel like, you can't be happy with where you are right now. You have to get to this other place, someplace out there, some time out there, but anywhere but where you are right now. You cannot be happy with where you are right now. And that makes the mind want to get ahead. It wants to get to the next thing. That's one thing that happens. And the other thing is that we have, we've laden ourselves with too much to do in a day, and I think we all know that, but we participate in it. And so the mind background task, when we're working on something that's right in front of us, and the mind says basically, well, while you do that, I'm going to go visit these other things that are coming on later in the day and try to figure that out so I can get a jump on it. And that's going on, too. There's a pull towards that. And so it creates all of this activity in the mind, and it makes the mind feel like being in the present is just not enough. It has to do more in order to solve all these problems that are facing us on a daily basis.
I know a lot of people don't like to hear the word meditation, and you use the phrase thought awareness training. What was your thought process for using that? Are you dealing with people who just don't like the sound of meditation?
No, I think that, I have studied meditation for about 35 years, and I have meditated for 35 years. I think that the problem with the word meditation is that it has a lot of connotations to it. Meditation is, it's a skill and it's a tool, and it's used for different things. You know, some people may use it in a religious pursuit. Other people may use it as a stress reliever. And I feel like the reason I called it the process that I was describing, thought awareness training, is because as a tool, the process, it's just a label. Meditation is a label for a process that we learn, a skill that we learn. And I think it's we can't accomplish anything if we don't understand that we are not our thoughts. That's the very first thing that we have to understand, is that our mind is a thought machine, and it will produce thoughts all day long, with or without your permission, and some of the thoughts that it produces are through your intention. You have an intention to solve a problem or something, but if you don't give the mind a problem to solve, it will go looking for one. I mean, they know this, and it's been studied, and so what happens is the mind is just running around all day, thinking and thinking and thinking, and it's being stimulated by all this input of media, and if you are not aware of that, then you basically are absorbed in all of the emotional content that comes from all the thinking. And if you were to say to somebody, what's the problem? And they said, I'm worrying. And you said, well, worrying is a thought. If you don't think, you can't worry. So because thought is the vehicle that moves you into the experience of worrying. You have a thought, there's an emotional content in that thought, and then you experience that emotional content. So if you want to stop that, you can, but the very first thing you have to learn is to be aware of what is your mind doing all day without your permission. You can't change it if you're not aware of what it's doing. So that was the reason why I called it thought awareness training. The very first step is learn what your mind's doing. Learn to separate yourself and be more of a noticer, more of an observer of what your mind is doing. And in that moment, when you are in that position, once you are the noticer, then you have a choice. You have the privilege of choosing. This thought is productive. This thought is going to serve my happiness. This thought is going to take me where I want to go. Or the other way, this thought is only going to make me feel bad. And then you have the opportunity to develop the willpower and the strength to stop it and redirect the mind. It's a training exercise.
Our guest on this Chief of Yourself is Thomas M. Stirner, the author of Fully Engaged, Using the Practicing Mind in Daily Life. as you said, you've been meditating for more than 30 years, and I think I've heard you say you don't really like guided meditations. I'm just wondering what type of meditation it works best for you.
Well, there's nothing wrong with guided meditations, but for thought awareness training, they really do not serve that purpose well because they require thinking. You know, in a guided meditation, someone is saying, they're telling you, visualize this, think about this, you know, put your attention on your left foot and feel that it relax. I mean, it's all of this, it's guided information, so it's instructions. And to me, what we want to do is watch the mind. We don't want to be thinking. We don't want to create thoughts. We want to just watch the mind. So the two types of meditation that are most suitable for this are the two oldest, which is just either watching yourself breathe or repeating a short mantra. And I tell people that if you want to use a mantra, a lot of people in the West prefer that because it is a thought. It does give their mind a bone to chew on, and that for some people may make the process easier. It doesn't matter what the mantra is. The mantra can be anything. It can be, I am still, I am happy, I like my daughter. It really doesn't matter. It's just a simple phrase that you can repeat over and over again. And you don't speak it with your mouth. You just hear it in your head. And the breath-based is, and for both of these, I should say that, you know, you sit in a chair. You want to remove any external stimulus as much as possible. Like, you shut your eyes. You don't want visual things happening because they will create thinking. And it should be as quiet as possible because you don't want that input. You just want to shut all the external sensory off as best you can. It doesn't have to be a soundproof room, but you're trying to get internal with this. And then what you do if you're watching your breath is you just close your eyes and let yourself breathe normally. And the temptation is, because we always want to be in control, is to try to control the breathing. We immediately start trying to slow it down, make the breath longer, and you need to let go of that. That's a little bit of a challenge for people when they first start. Just let go of it and let your body breathe. It doesn't need you to instruct it. If that's the one you're doing, if you're doing a mantra, then you just hear the mantra in your head over and over again. I think what's important, the biggest points to bring up is, what will you experience when you try to do this if you've never done it? Well, the first thing that will happen is you will think, I'm right on this, because the mechanics are very simple. But very quickly into it, your mind will go off because it doesn't like it. It's too simple. It's boring. It wants a problem to solve. And so it'll just go visiting something else. And you won't notice it because you will be where you spend most of your day, and that is absorbed in the thought process. And at some point, there'll be an instant when you wake up and you become completely present again, and you'll realize that you're thinking about a report at work or something you have to do later in the day or something that happened yesterday that's bothering you, and you'll realize, I'm not paying attention to my breath, I'm not paying attention to my phrase that I'm supposed to be saying. And it's in that instant there, right there, that's what you want. It's right in that instant when you catch yourself and you wake up, that's when your skill increases. It's like an exercise. You know, that's when you expand. And by pulling your mind back, you strengthen your ability to do so every time you do that. And that's what people need to realize. There's no such thing as a bad meditation, as a bad thought awareness session. It doesn't exist. You will have days where your mind is very busy and you'll chase your mind all the time, and you will have days where you're relatively calm and you will feel like you're really getting pretty good at it. That's because we tend to judge our progress based on how much we're chasing our mind, and that has nothing to do with it. In fact, I always find it amusing when people say, I'm not good at it because I'm constantly chasing my mind, and my response is, well, you can't be chasing your mind if you're not noticing what your mind is doing, and that's the whole goal, is to notice it. So if you're always chasing your mind, it means you're very aware of what your mind's doing. And that will translate out later in just waking life, where you will start to notice, I'm having this angry thought, or I'm having this worrying thought. And that sense, I'm having this thought. You're not in the thought, you're having the thought. And there's a separation there that is profound, because it gives you the opportunity. It will feel like, as it progresses, and you can't stop this from happening, it's a natural result of just this very simple process, doing it 10 to 15 minutes a day. What will happen is it will begin to feel like you're talking with someone and they're worrying, and they're telling you about how they're worrying. you're not worrying. You're just listening to them tell you about how they're worrying about something, but you're not experiencing their worry. And that's how it begins to feel, and that's the power that it begins to give you. It's so simple. It's free. It doesn't take a lot of time. And like I said, 10, 15 minutes a day. It's amazing what happens, and I think it's very important that people don't judge their experience in it and say, I'm not doing good because I'm always chasing my mind, or I'm having trouble doing it every day. You know, if you don't do it every day, then you just, and you're aware of it, then you just go back to doing it every day. I mean, you stop the whole judgment thing. It's just, it's like exercise. In exercise, you never master exercise. You don't get to a point in your life where you can say, I don't need to exercise anymore. The exercise is part of a healthy life, and this process of training the mind is a healthy part of life.
When we talk about people who worry about whether they're doing it right, they may be given to perfectionism. And I remember Joan Rivers saying that in the entertainment business, and I know this from doing many auditions and the rejection that happens, you have to enjoy the process. So are we talking about something similar here? You just have to enjoy the whole experience rather than get the result.
Yes, you're not, you know, there is... there is no, I'm not good at this. You know, everybody's good at it. They're an expert the first time they do it. You know, there is no good at this. There is no bad at this. It's just a process. As I said, it's a fallacy to think that in what we're trying to accomplish here, that you're going to get to a point where you have absolutely no thoughts. I mean, the people that, you know, meditate in the Himalayas, you know, 8 hours a day, still struggle with a mind that's active. This is now, you know, because they do so much of it, their skill level, you know, is higher. But it is the nature of the mind, and I think that that's not what we're after here. We're after the catching of the mind, the awareness of what the mind is doing. And when you can look at it like that, then you can just enjoy the process because, you know, as you're doing it, you're growing. Your skill is growing. Your ability to be aware of what your mind is doing and your ability to control it is growing just by you doing it. And so you feel, you begin to feel like, I'm right where I'm supposed to be. Right here, right now, I'm doing what I'm supposed to be, and it's a very satisfying feeling.
You mentioned in the book that conjures up a very positive feeling amidst a world that is so uncertain today. You talk about a global awakening that's currently happening in the world. Tell us more.
Well, I think that, you know, the conversation we're having today, we certainly wouldn't have had 25 years ago. And this is where, you know, this is... There's a paradigm here that's being busted that, you know, if you look at, like, the concept of multitasking, you know, we now know that multitasking doesn't exist. It's actually called now switch tasking because every time when we think we're doing three or four things at one time, we're not doing three or four things at the same time. Our brain is stopping and starting over and over again. And, you know, there's a very simple test you can do to prove this to yourself. It was brought to my attention by a guy named Dave Crenshaw who wrote a book called The Myth of Multitasking. And, you know, if you take a sentence and you write the sentence out, and the sentence that he used in his example was, multitasking is worse than a lie. If you write that sentence across the piece of paper, you start a timer, and instead of writing multitasking is worse than a lie, you write a letter, and then you number the letters. So you write M, and underneath of it you write 1, and then you write the letter U, and then underneath that you write 2, all the way across the page, and you time that. And then when you're finished with that, then you start over again, and you just write the sentence, multitasking is worse than a lie, and go back and write 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 up until you have numbered all the letters. And what you find when you do that is that it takes about 30, it depends on the person, but, you know, like 35 to 45% less time when you do it the second time, just writing the sentence and writing the numbers. Now, what it shows you is that most people think when they're writing an M and then a 1 and then a U and then a 2, they're only doing one thing, but they're not doing one thing. They're asking the brain to go from one set of you know, information to another set, and the brain is stopping and starting and stopping and starting. It's just that it happens so quickly that we feel like we're doing it all at the same time. And what they've learned about this is that it's totally unproductive. This thing about switch tasking, it steals mental stamina. It takes people longer to do the things, all sorts of things. And so that's part of the paradigm that's being busted. All the sports psychology that is out there has learned that when we are functioning, when we are totally present, we're completely fully engaged in what we're doing right now, then we are functioning at our highest level. This stuff has been said for thousands of years, but now through all of this, these university studies and tests and sports, which is really where it was, I think, it's percolated up into the society, because in sports, you know, they have really gotten the physical prowess part of it. You know, if you just look at golf, I mean, they have all these computer analysis. You wear these suits, and they can analyze every part of a golf swing, and they can see how do we maximize the transfer of energy from the golf club to the ball. What swing motions have to happen? They can do all this math on that, so they know how what the most powerful golf swing looks like. Well, once you get to that point, how do you increase performance? Well, now it's on the shoulders of the mind. The mind has to do it, and that's why there's been so much study in what is holding us back mentally. And what they've learned from this is that it's this present moment functioning. We need to be in the present. When we do that, our experience of what we're doing, of our achieving our goals, is completely different than it is when we're attached to the moment we actually realize the goal. So these are things that have been all proven out. They've all been documented, and this is the transformation that's happening globally. It's becoming accepted, and that's the reason why we can talk about this on a show like this today, and people aren't going, what? It's being talked about in corporations. It's being talked about in sports. It's being talked about in ways of helping kids to focus better, ADD. All these different areas are looking at this this paradigm shift, and everybody's benefiting from it.
I know you have several websites. I have tomsterner.com. Is that where we're directing interest in the book?
Yeah, I think that's a good place to start. I have the practicingmind.com and the Practicing Mind Institute, but there are lead-offs from there, from tomsterner.com. There's, you know, you can find ways to purchase the books from that website. You can find out more about me. There's actually a video. There's some videos on the homepage about Fully Engaged, which has just come out, that where I'm interviewed directly about the book. People were more curious about that. So that, I think tomsterner.com is an excellent place. They can also email me, too, at tom@tomsterner.com, or the contact form, and they will send it to the same place.
All right. The book is Fully Engaged, Using the Practicing Mind in Daily Life by Thomas M. Sterner, our guest today. Tom, thanks for doing the interview, giving us another great book, and for sharing your own story with us. So come back and make it a third time. That'd be great.
I would love to. Third time's a charm. So let's plan on it.
You'll see a link to Thomas Sterner's website on the start page of chiefforyourself.com. Visit that page if you're not there now, and leave your email address in the box provided, and that will get you the Genuline's blog posts, and that's always the best way to keep informed as to who our next guest will be, and when to go to the chiefforyourself.com start page to hear the call, and to also get any other information about the show. That's going to do it for today. Thanks so much for making Chief for Yourself your listening choice. Be well, and I'll talk to you soon.